I'm very glad to be here in St. Cloud. I must confess that I had never heard about St. Cloud until I got that very gracious invitation. But it's been my experience in traveling around the country since I had my consciousness raised that this country is full of institutions of higher learning that have enormous plants, large numbers of bright students, and making great contributions to the educational system of the United States. These institutions, like St. Cloud, tend at the present time to have about 50% women students. When it comes to faculty, however, the situation is somewhat different, and St. Cloud is just about par for that particular course. Lousy. And I'd like to discuss with you tonight some of the reasons for this, as far as I can understand them, and what I think possibly might be done about it. You know, this is International Women's Year, and there is something a little ironic about having to have International Women's Year. Obviously, no one in his right mind would have asked the United Nations to have an International Men's Year. Every year is International Men's Year. And as a measure of the devotion of the United States of America to this new concept of woman as person, we have made a great contribution to International Women's Year. Now, one of the things I like about the United States is, if you're native here and you've lived here long enough, you get to know what the country really values. Not what it says it values, but what it really values. Now, what it really values, it usually pays for. Whether it's automobiles or chewing gum or massage parlors, you get to know what people are willing to pay for, and this is reflected in what the government is willing to pay for and what the government values. I live in the Washington area. Many of my best friends are politicians. And they tell me ad nauseum about how much they love women. Well, so did Henry VIII. Now, this love for women manifests itself in many ways. And one of the ways it manifests itself is in the appropriation for International Women's Year. $300,000, which is about one half of what was appropriated for National Pickle Week. And one-tenth of what the smallest of the Western nations has appropriated for International Women's Year. So much for what we value. Now, International Women's Year in the United States is, as far as the government is concerned, is a little bit like Mother's Day. I am a mother, and I find I've been sold a bill of goods like all other mothers on Mother's Day. My children are grown and gone, and there are grandchildren now. And I, when Mother's Day dawns, I'm always slightly nervous that they won't call me up or send me some flowers, because I've been brainwashed. At least on Mother's Day, mothers should be valued. And M is for the many things she gave me. And O is for what she gets the other 364 days out of the year. Now, I find International Women's Year to be a very important concept. The mere fact that it's being recognized is sort of in the nature of being thankful for small blessings. But what we need is not International Women's Year, but an international ongoing recognition that there is a problem relative to the relationships between men and women. And curiously, it is very difficult to get people to recognize that there is a problem. Not that people are happy about it. I have never talked to any woman, however conservative, however anti-feminist, however much she is disgusted by the kooks in the women's liberation movement, the ones that keep telling me about these silly bra burners. I've never talked to any woman, including that kind of woman who is usually a very frightened woman, where if I probed long enough and talked to her in terms that she and I both understood in our common humanity and femininity, as for example, I have many mischievous techniques, and one of them is to start talking to such a woman about men in general, but not men in terms of the fact that they don't give women jobs, because these women tend to be very frightened of the concept of women working, but talk to such a woman in terms of the way households are run. Say something about the fact that men are really boys. They're children. Immediately, their ears perk up, and they will agree with you. And then you'll begin to find a common ground. You tell them about how your husband leaves the wet towels in the bathroom after a shower, and she will tell you how he can never find anything, even if it's right under his nose. Then I will tell her about the time that I fixed a magnificent dinner and he was an hour and a half late. Then she will tell me about the time that he didn't even notice that she had prepared a cordon bleu dinner. And then pretty well along the way, we begin to rev up a bit. And before you know it, this divinely happy woman is spewing out the most intense hostility to men that I have yet encountered in the women's movement. She loves men like Lucrezia Borgia. Now, I have never talked to any man, however sympathetic to women's plight or women's problems, who, if you pressed hard enough, did not begin to reveal an intense anger at women. This is a sad and perhaps natural thing, because no man knows what it's like to be a woman, and no woman knows what it's like to be a man. And we gaze at each other across an enormous chasm of experience, which is unique to each sex, and each in his or her heart feels that somehow the other one is getting more than he or she deserves. And both are right, because men and women deserve each other. We do everything we can to destroy each other and ourselves in the social process. And the reasons for it go all the way back to perhaps the earliest relationships of the species Homo sapiens, where work had to be delegated and survival was brutal. And what one person got was something less than the other person could get from the same small pot. And it is not surprising to me that we are still in the state of regarding each other as dangerous animals. In every religion, which was designed, of course, in each case by men, you are confronted with this classification of women as the enemy. Every religion, but the beloved enemy, with whom you can, as the old saw goes, neither live with nor live without. The Jews, the Orthodox Jews, a male Orthodox Jew, thanks God every morning that he was not born a woman. In Christianity, of which we know practically nothing, the Bible states quite explicitly that in matters of judgment on most things, women are inferior to men, and that the man is the master of the woman. And St. Paul, who despised women, recognized that this was a terrible problem and finally, reluctantly said, it is better to marry than to burn. You need her in bed, but don't let her use that as a weapon against you. Because women in Christianity are essentially the temptresses, tempting men from their innocence. Now, the Bible is an interesting brochure book. It starts out with Adam and Eve. And it says that Eve was taken from the rib of Adam and, of course, was sort of slightly secondhand. With some Adam. Now, I happen to be an endocrinologist, physiologist, biologist, and biology frequently doesn't go along with human concepts of what life is really like, not when you get the evidence. Because you see, it turns out that the basic pattern created was not male, but female. In utero, when there is a fertilized ovum, whether the sperm is carrying a Y chromosome or an X chromosome, and the fertilized chromosome is now, fertilized egg is now XX or XY for the male, XX for the female. It doesn't really matter. The basic pattern is female. And if, for some reason, if you remove, for example, from either the male or the female fetus, the sex glands, all fetuses go on to become female because the female pattern is the basic pattern, and what the Y chromosome does is what the Bible said was done for Eve, but it's quite the other way around. The Y chromosome introduces another factor which now converts the basic female pattern to male. Now, I don't say that to make males feel bad. I'm simply telling you what the biology is like, and it doesn't mean a damn thing. Who cares? Now, it does mean something that in the Bible, Eve is regarded as essentially created because Adam was lonesome. To be essentially a playmate. Furthermore, the Bible is very interesting in this regard, and perhaps another way. You see, as a scientist, I greatly value curiosity and a questioning attitude towards dogma. And the greatest minds amongst humans, we would all agree, fall into the category of those that question always creatively the status quo and say, why and why not? Now that brings us back to Adam and Eve. Adam was told that things were perfect and would stay that way as long as the apple was not eaten. Now along came the first scientist, Eve. And she said to Adam, what do you suppose would happen if we ate the apple? And he said, don't rock the boat. But Eve's intellectual curiosity could not be so easily satisfied. And she kept after him and after him. She wanted to do the definitive experiment. And finally, since Adam wasn't a particularly strong character, she wore him down. And from that point on, they saw what happened when you ate the apple. And we've been looking at it ever since. Now, all of this would be fun and games, except that it isn't really, because prejudice against women is so pervasive that most women don't even know when they're being denigrated. They think they are being complimented. They think they are being cherished and cared for and protected. And they accept this gratefully. But for every bit of protection, for every there, little woman, let me take care of you, there is a price, and the price is dependence. And this is just as true for men as it is for women. When you are dependent economically, and I'll just put it at that level and not at the psychological level, when you're dependent economically on another human being, you give a hostage to fate. Because not only are you dependent for your bread and your butter and your shelter, you are dependent for your self-evaluation. Now, some years ago, somebody said to me, have you ever been discriminated against as a woman in medicine and in science? And I didn't even bother to think, because I was absolutely certain of the answer. I said, no, I haven't been discriminated against, but I know many women who have, and I think this is dreadful. Well, I didn't really think it was that dreadful, because you see, there's something rather comforting in being the only woman who has made it in a department, in a medical school, who's a full professor, when there aren't very many in medical schools throughout the country that have ovaries, or did have. Now, the comfort that comes is kind of interesting. If you're the only woman in a department, it's like being a Cocker Spaniel. A prize Cocker Spaniel. Everyone treats you very well. They pet you, pat you. And it just works beautifully. From time to time, they tell you that you really think like a woman. I'm sorry, like a man. That's the great compliment. They tell you you're thinking like a woman, they're insulting you. But when they tell you you think like a man, you say thank you, and you feel pretty good. And when they tell you, still, you're different. Then you preen yourself. You're not like all those other female slobs. You're different. And it's kind of nice. And you can feel a certain identification with the winners. After all, Who wants to associate with the losers? Women. So you cozy up to the power structure. Young men on the make do this. Young men don't try to associate themselves with the guys that have no power. They cozy up to the winners, to the men with power, and so do women. Why should a woman who is the only woman in an institution that has any kind of rank, even if she has tenure and they can't put a glove on her, why should she want to identify herself with women? They're nobody. They're not going to get you invited to the international conference in Paris. They're not going to pay off in any other way. Forget them. You made it and they didn't. Pull up the ladder. And that's the way most women who have made it behave and think and feel. They have very little strength as women. Now, when I saw the light, like Paul on the road to Damascus, I read in the New York Times that this surgeon, testifying before or speaking to the Democratic Policy Committee, made the statement that women, because of their raging hormones every month, were unfit for jobs of top responsibility. Now, the reason he said this stupid thing was that Patsy Mink of Hawaii had brought up the question of women's rights and equal employment opportunities. And this annoyed the hell out of a great liberal, this Dr. Berman, because he was bleeding for the people that really had problems. And he said essentially, how the hell can you bring up something trivial about these overfed American women living in their fur-lined suburban homes when we have real problems in this country? And then to just nail a thing down as really a subject of no consequence, he pointed out that even if women did have a problem, there's nothing you can do about it. Their raging hormones every month preclude their participation in the kind of decision making which requires testicles. Now, in the first place, he was a surgeon. Now, surgeons are a rare breed. They're the captains of the ship. They have to have a lot of take charge hormone, testosterone. Many of them don't. Around medical schools, there are many jokes. One of them goes, all gynecologists hate women, urologists hate men, and general surgeons hate everybody. Well, when I read that in the New York Times, I was understandably disturbed. I'm an endocrinologist. That was my union. I know about hormones. Furthermore, I have been working for quite a number of years on a very interesting question, and that is, why do men die earlier than women? That's an interesting one, because many of you, I'm sure, have read in the newspapers time and time again about the very high incidence of coronary artery disease in men in this country. An extraordinary incidence. It carries off some of our ablest, most valuable men in society at an age far too early. Whereas women go merrily on and on and on and on. And you often read about the fact that wives should feed their husbands low cholesterol diets, shovel the snow off the walk, because the man has a fragile cardiovascular system. And it's right. He does have a fragile system. What you don't read is that the fragility of his cardiovascular system apparently is a result of the effect of testosterone, whereas estrogens protect female hearts and blood vessels. And it is only the menopausal and postmenopausal woman that begins to have an incidence of coronary artery disease that begins to approach that of males. And even at that, in the age group between 90 and 100, the man that lives to that age group and the woman that lives to that age group, there is a higher death rate for men. Men are fragile. They need to be protected. They need to be cherished. Cover them up. Let us help them to live longer. Let us help them all the way to the bank. We will carry some of the money. Let us take some of the decision-making off their fragile shoulders. Because we put the most intolerable stresses on men in this society that could possibly be conceived. We tell them to begin with that to be a man is never to fail. Always to be strong. Never to cry. My grandson, when he was about 4 years old, said to me, "I wouldn't cry, Grandma. Boys don't cry." Well, God is not mocked. Everybody cries. Men cry with blood. They have 4 times the incidence of bleeding ulcers that women have. They cry. But they must not cry, except when their team wins a football game or something, and it's kosher to have a few tears of joy. But you must not fail. Let me point out to you that in this country, women attempt suicide at a rate of about 6 times the incidence of men. They do it to call attention to their agony in the most dramatic way that they know. But women are allowed to fail. In fact, it is success that unsexes women. If you're a woman and you're a success, you're defeminized. If you're a man and you're a failure, you're demasculinized. That's the way we've set this catch-22 up. Now, women attempt suicide, but they don't complete the act very often as compared to men. They use techniques that have a certain margin for error. Take an overdose, call a friend. Very good thinking. Men cannot fail even at suicide. So men have 3 times the death rate from suicide that women do in this country. How would it look to the boys at IBM if you tried to kill yourself and you didn't die? You couldn't face them. You were a failure even at death. Men don't give themselves an out. They have been told to use the most brutalizing weapons, and they use them on themselves. Put a gun in your mouth, blow off the top of your head. No room for error. That's the kind of burden we put on our men. And the benefits from this escape me. Because women are told that they are weak, and they are really strong. In fact, if Title IX is really pushed and we put educational opportunities in the area of sports at the same level of value for women as we do for men, starting from the earliest ages, and little girls get real physical conditioning, then women will never die. That's why they don't let us exercise. We have too much of an edge already. Just go down to St. Petersburg, Florida. All beauty parlors, no barbershops. All these little old widows, lonely, poor, most of them, living out sterile lives because their men have died with their boots on, with a stiff upper lip, cool. Well, the stiffest and coolest people are in the graveyard, and that's where we hasten to send our men, all the time telling them that this is a much better way to live, that is to die. Now, of course, all of this is sub rosa because we have a schizophrenia about women. Women, to a physician and to insurance companies, stand clear, strong, vigorous, biologic marvels. Now, I have nothing against testosterone. As hormones go, it's not a bad hormone. And no home should be without some. But what I object to is the denigration of estrogens. Now, those are hormones. Now, I haven't said anything about what they do to the brain, however, because you see, all of this simply says that we survive like vegetables. Now, why do the people of Minnesota pay millions of dollars a year to educate women in this great state? I haven't the foggiest notion. Why do we spend more than $20 billion a year keeping women in college? Who knows? A woman with a college degree today averages working full-time as much as a man with an eighth grade diploma in the trades. Why we educate women, I will never know. We certainly don't intend to use them. It's the poorest investment a country could ever make. Now, I am told it makes women better wives and mothers. Garbage. My mother could hardly read or write. Little French peasant girl who spent her life agonizing over the fact that she was ignorant. She was a magnificent mother. It is because of my mother that I have the education that I have. Because like so many Americans who were immigrants to this country, she felt this terrible hunger for education. What she didn't have, the old American dream, her children would have. But she was different from many mothers. She accepted the fact that of course my brothers would get an education. My father was a doctor, and so his sons would be educated. But she knew perfectly well, and remember, this is almost 60 years ago when I was born, that my chances of being encouraged to get an education were minimal, even though we were an upper middle class family. As my father, who loved me dearly, I was the apple of his eye, used to say to me, "Oh, honey, why are you studying so hard? You're such a pretty little girl." He did it out of love as he tried to turn me into a vegetable, a plant. Not out of hate, but out of the deepest love, he wanted to protect me. And his idea of protection was to turn me over to another good, hard-working man who would support me. And he was proud of my Phi Beta Kappa key, finally. But it was kind of, it was almost amusing. Here was his pretty little girl, and she got into Phi Beta. It wasn't important. He made life a misery for my brothers if they got less than a B. But he really wouldn't have cared very much if I had gotten a gentleman C. And not because he didn't care about me. My point is that the blindness that afflicts us is what destroys women. Women in the middle class of America are usually well taken care of by their fathers, their brothers, and even their husbands. But that's not the point. My mother knew, because of her own deep pain and her own ignorance, what it was like to be a complete captive within a body that had a brain that had not been developed. And from the day I was born, she kept saying to me, if you don't get an education, you might as well be an animal. And I thank God every day that my mother, without her education, was the magnificent mother that she was. She didn't need an education to be a good mother. As far as being a good wife is concerned, it's like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. What's a good wife to one man is a shrike to another. So getting an education to become a good wife and mother is pointless. All you have to do is to know how to read the soap boxes. You can't help your kids with their stuff because they teach them differently. With all my degrees, I couldn't help my kids with their math. I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And I was a math major at college. But so it goes. No, I don't think that's a good enough reason to spend billions of dollars on women. And I also don't think that any society can afford to waste 53% of its brains, which is what we're doing right this minute. There are virtually no women in this country in major decision-making positions. Oh, the occasional woman gets appointed to housing and urban development. I happened to be making a speech at the University of California the day that was announced, and the first question from the audience, from a woman, was, do you think that Carla Hills really has the qualifications to do the job? Well, it's like the old joke of, how's your wife? Compared to what? Compared to the people who preceded her, she's got no place to go but up. I don't know anything about her. I just figure the competition isn't that keen. Now, that's the one thing that uneducated people never quite realize, and that's one thing that women in particular are misinformed about. Because women are excluded from the executive suites, from the higher reaches, from the great world out there. They are under the delusion that the people who are included have something they haven't got. All you have to do is to walk into the executive suite and listen for a while. And then your modesty will disappear. Because you see, it turns out that men who are in high positions, low positions, and mediocre positions fall into three general categories, in my experience. Some are absolutely brilliant, magnificent. Some are horses' asses. And most are mediocre hacks. And women are just as mediocre as men. We can do just what men do in terms of mediocrity. And some of us will be brilliant, and some of us will be horses' asses, and most of us will be mediocre hacks. In that company, there's no difference. When a woman thinks she has to be an Albert Einstein to become an assistant professor, then she's defeating herself. All she has to do is to look around at the full professors. And she will recognize that people rise in society like oil on the water for a variety of reasons. Now, have I been discriminated against? Well, I started to think back over several things that had happened to me and when my eyes were opened, and I thought of a few incidents that I didn't regard at the time as discrimination. In the Depression, there were very few jobs. I had a job offer for an interesting reason. I had just gotten out of college in the mid-30s, And as so often happens, and must happen to any woman that makes it, because you see, at every door stands a man. At every door, anywhere, stands a man in this society. And for any woman to make it, some man has to open a door to her. And then some other man has to open the door. You cannot fight tanks with pea shooters. It cannot be done. And in my own life, at critical times, there has been a decent, honorable man who, like Samuel Johnson, when asked which is more intelligent, man or woman, said, which man and which woman, and opened the door to me. That's all you need, just having the door open for you. But I remember at the time I got my first job, I had to take a degree in physical chemistry in order to keep the job. And I was taking a good many physics courses at the time. Wasn't particularly interested in physics, but that was part of the job requirement. And I'd have taken a degree in Sanskrit to get a job. And I took four courses. Three were didactic courses, one was a laboratory course, and I worked very hard. I got three A's in the didactic courses and an A minus in the lab course. And I applied for some fellowship support. Since I was making $750 a year and the tuition was $1,600, there was, like Macaba, something was going awry. So I applied for some help. And the chairman of the department, who was very fond of me, would have been very happy, I think, to have me marry his son, or something like that. But he didn't think that I belonged in physics, because physics was a man's world. But at any rate, he looked at my record and he said, Estelle, I see you have trouble in the laboratory. I didn't get the fellowship. The next thing that happened to me that might be considered to be discriminatory, when I got married, and my husband suddenly, in the tricky way that husbands do, announced a month after we were married that we were moving to Knoxville, Tennessee, absolute blot, I went down there with him, a starry-eyed bride, and very rapidly became bored to desperation, because I'd always worked. So I applied to the University of Tennessee, to the Department of Chemistry, for a job. My credentials were very good. And the chairman of the department said to me, Dr. Ramey, I have never hired a woman. I will never hire a woman. Go home and take care of your husband. See, I was never discriminated against. I had conveniently forgotten that. Well, what happened, of course, was that was in early 1941. And then, of course, to the great advantage of women, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And within a few months, I got a telephone call from this prince. And he said to me, with no introduction, he said, Dr. Ramey, it is your patriotic duty to come and teach air cadets. So I said, well, I tell you, Dr. Beelum, I took your advice. I took such good care of my husband. I'm pregnant. He brushed that off as a mosquito. He said, Dr. Ramey, our men are dying at the front. He was back in World War I. So I said, yes, sir, and I went, and I taught up until about 3 days before I delivered, and did this with a couple of kids during the war. Nobody was particularly surprised, because you see, women are only fragile when it is convenient for them to be fragile in the society. And then the war ended, and our men came back from the front to the University of Tennessee, and by that time, the chairman and I were very good friends, and he called me in, and it was on a first-name basis, and he said, Estelle, you've done a magnificent job for your country. We can never repay you, and we shall miss you. Because I had taken a man's job. It was written in tablets of stone that was a man's job. Now, this fragility of women is a very interesting one. Women have used it because they've used it as a way to manipulate men. But only women who essentially have some money can afford to be fragile. And even there, in the situation of a family with four kids, papa and mama, all down with the flu, terribly ill, papa is sicker than anybody, he's almost moribund. He's up in the bedroom with a fever of 98.9. Who's in the kitchen at 4 o'clock in the morning making tea and toast and wiping up the kids' vomit? Fragile little mama with a fever of 110. Is anyone surprised? Of course not. Of course not. Mothers are like that. I would like the real American woman to stand up. Who are we? Fragile flowers of the South, or strong, indomitable pioneer women who went across this great country and birthed their babies in covered wagons and in fields and leaped up immediately and began shooting Indians? Who are we? Well, I tell you who we are. We're probably the strongest women in the world because we are the daughters of women who had survival value, whether they came over here in slave ships, or in the Mayflower, or in the steerage of those cattle boats coming from Central Europe. Those women were strong, or else they died. And we are their children. And we have no right to protest our weakness, because we are not weak, we are strong. And as far as female intellect is concerned, nowadays when somebody says, I've done something particularly well in science, my answer to that is, that's because I think just like a woman. Because in every aspect of life, where there is problem solving, the one thing that you want to avoid is to have everybody involved in the solution thinking the same way. I believe that women have a different perception of the world than men do. How could we help it? From our social conditioning, from our very biology, from our cycles that are so much more obvious than the very real male cycles, which they deny. We bleed every month, a remarkable phenomenon. We're the only animal, the human female, that bleeds every month with impunity and then rises like the phoenix. It is not a curse. We produce new life, with a little help. I don't want to run down the male of the species. I am really not terribly interested in the research that's going down to eliminate them from the process. On the other hand, I feel that women have a right to be proud of themselves, and yet they run themselves down. And the tragedy is that we are taught from the time we are little girls that every other woman is our competitor in a very curious way. We're all competing for the brass ring, or the gold ring, depending on your point of view, a man. And if she gets them, I don't. And since there is no other reason for even trying to achieve, if you're a woman, you see around Washington, if you happen to be the wife of a senator, you can have two heads. You get invited everywhere. Has nothing to do with you. You're an instant success because of the man you married. And women know that. It's the only way women have been able to move upward, is to marry upward. They haven't been able to do it on the basis of their very real brains. And yet, the waste that's involved doesn't even bear thinking about. In my laboratory, when we're solving problems, I want graduate students and postdoc fellows and associates who, like the blind men and the elephant, approach the elephant from every possible different point. If we're all feeling the ears and we draw the elephant that way, we will never find a cure for cancer. The male establishment runs science. Now, you might say that's why we haven't got a cure for breast cancer, but it's not as simple as that. The male establishment that runs science does not even investigate why men die early. And as my colleagues tell me, maybe we'd rather not know. So much for what we do to men, persuading them that that weakness in males must never even be confronted. So there is as much damage done in research to men as to women. Women have a perception to bring to bear on problem solving that we know nothing about. Oh, there's an odd woman like me, a few who have been involved in some aspects of decision making, but not very many. We just don't know. A very intelligent young woman, just before we came into this lecture hall tonight, asked me the question, essentially, what are women capable of doing? What will happen if we realize their potential? And my answer to her was, nobody knows. We've never tried it. We don't know what kind of a world it could be if 53% of the population were involved in decision making. We do know one thing, that since they've been excluded, it's not a very good world. And for every woman who, like the older version of myself, says, I've never been discriminated against, I have only this to say, that you cannot separate yourself from your own kind. It's like saying some of my best friends are Jews. That means the rest of Jews are worthless. But some of my friends, I'll admit, are different. If somebody says to me these days, you're different, that's an insult. Because I can never be different from other women. I am a woman. You can't separate yourself from your own kind. No matter how much you may achieve, you remain a woman and you are tarred with the same brush of inferiority. And I have told my family that what I want on my tombstone is, dear God, she tried to be her sister's keeper. Because until women regard each other as sisters, in this trite phrase, sisters, and until we help each other, we can never help our men. We will ride like an incubus on their shoulders. And no one benefits from this structuring. And when Freud raised his hands to heaven and said so wistfully, dear God, what does a woman want? There isn't a woman in this audience that couldn't have told the old boy. She wants everything. That's all. She may not get it, but she wants it. And that's what a man wants. She wants to love and be loved, and that's what a man wants. She wants to protect and be protected, and that's what a man wants. She wants to lead and she wants to be led. That's what a man wants. She wants to be weak and she wants to be strong. And that's just what a man wants. They both, poor souls, just want to be that most contradictory of all living creatures, Homo sapiens, the thinking ones, that carry with them in that little black box of the cranium the jewel of evolution, the human cerebral cortex. We don't have the slightest idea what the female cerebral cortex can do. Nothing. My guess is that amongst us, there must be some geniuses. There must be, statistically. And those are the geniuses that are so desperately needed to solve not only scientific problems, but sociological problems. And until this is recognized, that it is in the self-interest of men to develop female potential, because every woman is in some way part of some man. And when a woman is underpaid, her husband is underpaid. And in this country, very soon, all families will have to have two salaries to stay alive. And when you underpay a woman of that family who is working for trivial pin money, for frosting on the cake, like paying the rent and buying the kids' shoes, when you underpay her, her husband has to work that much harder. And a man who is complacent about his wife's underranking and underpayment is a fool. And if he worries when her salary gets close to his, or God forbid, she might make even more, then he's an idiot. Because every penny that she makes is one less penny he's got to kill himself for. And the problem is not victory. It is survival. And so, in conclusion, I can only say this to you, and it's a paraphrase of the famous John Donne quotation, that no woman is an island entire in herself. Every woman's put down diminishes me, for I am part of humankind. And therefore, my brothers and sisters, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It always tolls for thee. Thank you.